Wasn't there a famous, I hate to say Armada, going towards Bayhead, hit by a hurricane and many ships went down?
Oh, yeah. No,
do they know where that was at?
Repeatedly. Well, that was the 1622 fleet, which we have the Atocha and the Santa Margarita. There are two ships in the Tortugas that are right there, still out there in the National Park waters. There were two that were swamped in deep water. One was found in 1991 by a group called Seahawk. Deep Ocean Technology. They partially excavated that. It's in about 1,500 feet of water. One missing, and then there's another one that's missing. Another two that are missing. There were eight out of 28 ships, let's say. But you also have the 1733 fleet, which wrecked from Marathon up into Key Biscayne. 20 ships, virtually all of them were lost but one. Then on the east coast of Florida, you have the 1715 fleet, which was another Spanish fleet headed back and got caught by a hurricane.
How come they kept on sending them back on that bad stretch of where they shouldn't be sailing?
It's what you had. It was, you know, despite the hazards, it was still the best way. And poor ships were the only way. That was the best route. Following that Gulf Stream, you know, that great highway of the sea that starts here and goes on up, carries them on back to Europe.
And the square riggers couldn't go against the trades, and
right,
that was
right.
When you hear about Columbus's crew being afraid, what they were afraid of was not falling out to earth. They were afraid about running out of food and not being able to go home because they had been riding the trade winds all the way across the ocean.
And they get stuck.
And they were stuck and no way home, and they thought the ocean was just going to keep going. But you're talking about finding stuff. You remember Dennis and the guys up from Key Largo?
Yes.
Dennis
Trelowitz.
Trelowitz. He was a volunteer for the National Marine Sanctuary. And he spent days out there just running up and down patterns. And he found all sorts of things laying on the bottom that were in plain view that nobody had ever seen. But he just very meticulously went one line after another. He wrote a couple articles for us that appeared in our journal. Unfortunately, he passed away pretty young.
Yes, sir.
There seem to be huge technological advances being made, enormous, between satellites, between underwater technology, between just everywhere you look. Is it not reasonable to think that, say, from 10 years ago for another 40 years in the future, is probably going to be the absolute heyday of marine archaeology, and basically you will have found 80-90% of all the things that are of real interest probably by the end of that period.
Perhaps.
I mean, we're living in an absolutely fascinating time.
Oh, it is. Absolutely. And it is getting easier to document things on the water, to find things on the water. Absolutely. Sure, you know, you may be in 40, 50 years to have some device. You know, we can't use radar in salt water right now, but that may change at some point. We'll be able to penetrate right through the bottom and see what's down there. Who knows? You know, that doesn't sound unreasonable to me. So what I've seen just in the time I've been doing it. So, yeah, I mean, you look at how Mel Fisher was looking for the Atocha just in the 70s and 80s. Versus what you can do today, it's phenomenal. Night and day, two different worlds. Absolutely.
Yeah. And the other place is what Corey spends a lot of time is the Spanish were great documenters.
Yes.
And at Archives of the Indies, which they're still working on, and he spends a lot of time with that stuff, and you're finding more and more stuff documented.
Yes. Those are now becoming, so you can access them online. You know, I can sit at my desk and read documents about shipwrecks I'm studying. And before, I could only wonder and hope that someday I'd get to Seville and get a license to look at, you know. And now I just click, there it is, download it as a PDF, and I take it home and read it. You know, I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah. So. It's not quite as simple as he said.
It's a relative thing. Yeah.
It's archaic Spanish.
Yes, sir.
Corey, you gave a presentation, a little lecture just a few weeks ago over at the Eco Center.
Yeah.
I was there, and one of the points you made were really interesting that I had never thought about. That is the magnetometer readings. When you got the various blips, and you found one blip that was a prehistoric or an early civilization.
Right.
non-metallic.
Right.
Would you just spend a second or a minute or two on that? That was so interesting.
Absolutely. What he's referring to is myself and the museum, Mel Fisher Maritime Museum, partnered with the RPM Nautical Foundation, and we did magnetic surveys out at New Ground Reef, which is about 35 miles west of here. And we were looking for what might remain of the Henrietta Marie, the slave ship that wrecked in 1700, that we've studied. And we have about half the ship, but the other half is gone, and we thought we might try to find it. So we went out there and did these magnetic surveys, measured the Earth's magnetic field out over New Ground Reef, and we got all these wonderful magnetic anomalies. And that, to us, we hope means shipwrecks, cannons, anchors, hull structure with iron nails, that sort of thing. And sure enough, there they were, lots of them right in the area of the Henrietta Marie. And we filed for permission with the Marine Sanctuary to uncover some that we thought were pretty likely. And dug down, we're in one case in about 45 feet of water, dug down about 5 feet into the seabed. We use a dredge about that big around, like an underwater vacuum cleaner. Dug down, got 5 feet in the seabed, hit this whole layer of wood and just other organic stuff. Well, that was great. We thought, well, this might be dunnage from the ship or something. When we started looking closer, it's like, no, this just is something natural. How bizarre is that? So we sampled some of it, found pine, mangrove, pine cones, just some organic sort of muck we couldn't quite figure out. Sampled it, sent it off to a lab in Miami for a carbon-14 analysis. It was 8,500 years old.
Whoa.
And what we had found was prehistoric Florida. it was specifically the shoreline, because we had the mangroves. If you can envision a shoreline along Big Pine Key or maybe the Everglades or something, where it was a mix of pine and mangrove. We had oysters, some still stuck on little bits of mangrove, intertidal creatures. So pretty clearly a shoreline. But that meant, and the geologists all said, oh yeah, it makes perfect sense. The water's come up 50 feet in 8,000 years. So that was a pretty stunning fact. But the other thing we were finding was fire, evidence of fire, burned rock, burned wood. And it turns out, which I had never thought of or heard of in my life, a principle called thermoremanent magnetism. And it's a mouthful. But when something is heated above 600 degrees Celsius, it takes on the magnetic field at that time. And then when the fire goes out, it cools. And that magnetic field stays frozen to that time. Well, the Earth's magnetic field is always shifting. It's shifting as we speak. And so what was the magnetic north 8,000 years ago is no longer the magnetic north, and it stands out like a sore thumb in our magnetometers. So we were fighting old forest fires, basically. We found quite a few of them. So interesting you bring that up. I just had a professor from Florida State call me today and said, hey, I heard about this stuff you found out. And they want to pick up and carry on that research because they are looking for human habitation sites from the paleo period, 10, 12,000 years ago. And they found quite a few off the west coast of Florida up towards the panhandle there. But hearing about what we had found, he's thought it's completely viable that they could find something here as well. So so that may get going again this summer. I would not be the lead on that, but that's neat that it can carry on like that. So,
how deep was that forest fire?
We actually found about five spots that were like that. They were all around 50 feet by the time we dug.
50 feet?
Okay. Yeah. We had 45 feet of water and then another 5 feet into the bottom.
Is there any recovery work still going on at the Etosha?
The Fisher family has their operation that they still are looking for the rest of the Etosha and the Santa Margarita. The Etosha is scattered over about a 10-mile area, so even though the cargo hold was found in 1985, that was the big thing that made all the news. There's still a lot that tumbled around and went farther or further behind or whatever. So they're continuing that search. I'm not a part of that. The museum is not a part of that. We're doing other research, like what I talked about at Newground Reef, working on the Marie J. Thompson in Key West Harbor here, and working on a wreck called the Guerrero off the North Key Harbor. So we've got a lot of neat research going on, but not the...
What's the latest on the St. John?
Sure. The St. John's,
what it is.
Yeah, the St. John's wreck is a wreck that was in... wrecked off of Grand Bahama that was found about 20 years ago by a treasure hunting group called St. John's Expeditions. And they called me and said, we found this shipwreck. We don't know what it is. Would you come look at it? And I don't normally answer those calls or go, you know, check those things out. But this was so intriguing. They were describing cannons that they had found and a helmet. And I said, okay, if you guys will get me over there, I'll go look at it. And went over there, stuck my face in the water. The wreck was in 15 feet of water. Bahamas water is clear as a bell. If you're, looked in, bingo, saw this pile of cannons sitting there, and said, guys, don't do any more work. It was very obviously a ship from the 1500s. No matter what, was going to be interesting and important. And... we talked, and over the next few months, struck a deal where they basically turned the wreck over to our museum. No questions asked. Said, take it, study it, do what you want with it. We worked with the Bahamian government on structuring that. And for the next 7 years, slowly excavated this site. And we didn't know what it was. We knew it was an early wreck, Spanish, going back to Spain. There didn't seem to be any evidence that anybody had died. We never found any bones, never found any buttons, buckles, rings, that kind of stuff. There was no treasure on it, but there was a lot of ship's hull structure, a lot of tools, a lot of weapons, a lot of day-to-day things, dishes, that sort of stuff. A fascinating look into that early Spanish conquest. I gotta give a formal lecture on this. But anyway... We, like I say, did that excavation over 7 years. It took us a while, but we finally got enough evidence together to go to the archives in Seville. This was before you could go online, and had to get Eugene Lyon, who had worked with Mel Fisher for many years, and another researcher in Seville. And took that information. We had a 20-year window. This shipwreck between 1555 and 1575. We could see that from the artifacts and the different qualities I just told you about it. And they came up with just a small number of ships that it could have been. But one really stood out like a sore thumb, and that's a ship called the Santa Clara that wrecked in 1564. Was a Spanish galleon, an early galleon, was sailing with a fleet of three ships. They had gone from Spain to South America, Panama, and Cartagena and Colombia. They delivered a lot of VIPs to South America. I was just telling a couple folks here, I found the passengers list a couple of weeks ago, and had the new president of Peru, which was all of South America at the time, not on our ship, but on one of the other ships with it, one of the three. Had a new president of man in charge of Quito, which was northern South America. We had Atahualpa's son, who Atahualpa was the Inca emperor, the Inca lord, who Pizarro defeated. His son had met with King Philip and was going back home. A whole slew of conquistador type people. Are putting that story together now using all this archival material, and it's very clear that as I've been going through over the past few months, I've got at least 8 accounts that tell us where the ship wrecked, and it's exactly where our site is. So I'm convinced, that no doubt in my mind, even though we don't have a bell that says Santa Clara or anything, that this wreck we're dealing with is a Santa Clara. A lot of neat research is going to be coming out of that as this comes along. So, you know, like I said, I need to do a lecture. It'll be well worth it. So. Sir.
With all those luminaries from countries that didn't produce precious metals, was it not unusual for a ship returning to Spain, especially from, as one would guess, from some of those countries, not to be carrying precious metals?
Well, they did carry, and that's, I didn't get to that. They did carry precious metals. They wrecked. They went bump in the middle of the night, just sailed out of the channel. Literally, it just, I have an account of the wreck. And they ran aground in the middle of the night. The ship that they were sailing with, they fired a cannon and turned, lit a lantern, and the ship they were sailing with turned around and anchored off the reef. And when dawn came, they sent a shallop over and saw they couldn't get Santa Clara off the reef. They put divers in the water and everything. So they just took everything, got all the silver off, and got all the people off, and left everything else, and that's what we see. So, yeah. But kind of nice in a way to not have any treasure to worry about.
Yeah. In the legal section of the paper, every so often, there's these big, long ads that nobody can understand about Admiralty.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, what is that all about? It comes out several times a year, big, long, covers half the page.
Yeah, that's the Fisher family operation. And you'll see it. It was in today's paper, as a matter of fact, in the last couple of days. They have to run them every year, I believe. But what happens is they find a wreck in the open ocean, and the Atocha Margarita sites were considered this at one time. They bring up a piece of that wreck, an object from it, or a piece of the wreck itself. They go to what's called the Admiralty Court, and they have that wreck arrested. Literally, the wreck is arrested by the court. The court then becomes the custodian of that wreck and manages its affairs because the wreck can't do it itself. But it then allows the salver to operate as their proxy. And the salver then has to perform diligently and meet the standards that the court has outlined. And then they are awarded by the court the items that they recovered. That's it in a nutshell. That's kind of what David was going to talk about tonight, and he would have done it much better. But they have to publish public notice that their work is continuing, and if anybody has contests their work, to go before the court and say something. So if you got anything, better get down there.
How come the other one was getting the emeralds?
Yeah, and I don't know the story on those emeralds other than what I've read in the paper. It sounds awfully crazy to me. I just don't know. I'm totally out.
Now, has Fisher's son?
Yes.
Somebody
has found emeralds on the sea floor, so they say. They did exactly what Ray said. They had to run a notice in the paper. We found these. We've taken them to the court. The court is going to award them to us. If anybody has a claim on them, go tell the judge. Well, the Fishers, because a lot of emeralds were found on the wreck of the Atocha, and they have claim to the Atocha wherever it may lie. It's not just an area they have, but it's wherever that ship went to. They can salvage it. They said, well, those emeralds might be from the Atocha, and we want to find out. And so they filed a claim in court and said, prove that those are not from the Atocha. And so that's where that is now. But I don't have any insight beyond that.
How could they do that?
Pardon?
How could they prove they weren't?
Well, emeralds can be traced to very specific mines. And we know, it's known where the Atocha emeralds came from. Though that analysis has been done. So these match. And there are some signatures, from being immersed underwater for a long time. And that sort of. So there are ways to tell if they're from the same specific mine.
I went down to the forest on the Yankee, and it seemed to me they weren't too far from the forest.
Well, they said it was 40 miles away. And I know that sounds like a long, long way away, but you get a piece of wood floating, it's going to go. And 40 miles is not impossible. So that's it. I really don't know much beyond that. So, but that's kind of it. guys have stuff for Tom or John or...
I'll
yes, yeah, Ray, fire away. We'd love to hear the fountain of knowledge here.
Well,
Ray Blazevich, folks.
The thing is that when I got to Key West 55 years ago, you ask a lot of questions. And the local guy always gave me misinformation because he was given misinformation. You know, the reef is going to stop the hurricane or whatever else. And some of the things that people don't understand is, why could this be the largest city in Florida? You can't have a city without drinking water. Key West, the Upper Keys is a fossilized reef, and the ocean was much harder. But Big Pine Down, that reef is covered with precipitated limestone, which goes all the way to Dry Tortugas, and it's porous, and it holds fresh water. And that's why they could have a well here, and then they also had cisterns. And the other one is about names. And a lot of people don't understand why the Keys got certain names. And the Spanish always named it after a characteristic. Tortugas, because there were turtles there. Baca Key, Seacocks, Pine Island, so forth, Long Key, a large key. But when the Americans came through in about 1775, they always named it for the guy that lived there. It was Stockside. There weren't any cows there. S-T-O-K apostrophe S. It was Geiger's Key. It was Tom's Harbor. It was Knight's Key. It was Grassy's Key, not because there was any grass there. It was because Grassy lived there. And so a lot of people don't understand about the names. And then I think another one that people don't understand is our architecture. We have a northern architecture. When I grew up in northern Minnesota, I grew up in a two-story wooden house with a steep roof. And the reason you have a steep roof is snow doesn't slide off, and snow is heavy, and it breaks the roof. And so that's why you have that. And so I come to Key West, and there's thousands of snow roofs. And they don't have any snow here. And the same thing in the Bahamas. There's snow roofs down there. And the reason is, during the Revolutionary War, there's 21 colonies, but 13 of them revolt. And of the 13 colonies that revolt, about one-third of the Tories, they want to keep the king, one-third of the rebels, and they're chasing them out. And they took their homes, and 30,000 went to the three colonies in Canada that didn't revolt. A lot of them went to St. Augustine because he's in West Florida. They didn't come here because this was part of Cuba. But a lot of them went to the Bahamas and the Jamaica. And so when they got to the Bahamas, that northerner built the house he knew how to build. And then the question was, how did they get to Key West? And after the Revolutionary War, East and West Florida went back to Spain. But by 1819, she was so weak, and she wanted to keep Texas as part of Mexico. And the way we got Florida, we made a treaty we would never take Texas. That's all we ever paid for Florida. We wouldn't take Texas. But that didn't include the Keys. And then when the Congress wanted forts down here, Monroe Doctrine, they wanted to build a fort, and they told the Navy, go and take it. And in 1822, Lieutenant Perry come down here, and he didn't fight for it. He just took it. And what he did, in the Bahamas, agriculture didn't work, and they didn't have any trees left. They were logging off the trees in the Keys, and they were living off the wreck. So they either pull the ship back or they take the goodies. So they set up a court here, and they said you had to be a U.S. citizen and you had to go through this court. And the biggest migration we ever had was all the northerners that came here, and when they got here, they built a northern house, and wrecking attracted so many people, a lot of northerners came here directly. And again, that's why we have a northern architecture. And the reason you kept it, it actually made the house cooler with the scuttles and the construction of the thing. And then you went to the metal roofs because in 1886 you had a fire. You couldn't get insurance if you didn't have a metal roof. And a lot of things that are interesting. People, a good example is Garrison Blight. Why is it Garrison Blight? Because that's where the garrison was. Ferry Court was the Army garrison. And who was in charge of that? Major Dade in 1835 in the Indian War. And what he had orders to go to Gainesville to fight the Indians. So he put all the troops from the garrison here on a ship, went to Fort Myers, and he got up on his horse, he's the only guy with a horse, taking 150 men towards Gainesville, and the dumb Indians shot him off his horse and killed all his men. In honor of his ignorance, they named Dade County after Major Dade from the garrison at King Wilson. And then another one that you don't understand, they think that Fort Jefferson is built out of bricks. It's not built out of bricks. It's built out of concrete. It's covered with 20 million bricks. But how did they get the concrete to build that? Is that they got the calcium sand from the islands, they brought fresh water, they had cement. But to get the aggregate, the rocks, Senator Mallory would buy slaves and rent them to the army. And every day they went out there, and they would gather coral, and they had to smash it into little pieces. And in 1 year, 1,500 cubic yards, 1,500 cubic yards went into that fort, and they did that for 20 years. And I just figure out how much coral went in 20 years at 1,500 cubic yards a year. And so it's really made out of concrete. And on the photography, it's interesting. The Navy started laser photography, and their first range was between Boca Chica and the Sambos. And the reason for this is, in a lot of areas of the world where we might have to make landings, they don't have accurate charts. So they found out by shooting a laser beam down that 90% of it gets reflected, but there is 10% that hits the bottom and comes back. And this whole area has been laser photographed, and now even civilians are doing it. They're actually photographing the bottom of that.
Yeah, they're doing, like Ray's talking, they call it LIDAR, is what they call it. They just fly a plane over. They've done a lot of NOAA has done a lot of the reef structures that way. Beautiful imagery. You get this 3D image of the reef right through the water, and yeah, can't see the shipwrecks, but you can see the reef. It's really nice.
In 1822, the Navy wanted to know whether the Navy could be based here. So they did an investigation. Lieutenant Patterson writes back his letter. He says, Key West is full of big trees, all kinds of deer, lots of fish, but to get fresh water, which was the important thing, the whole island was covered with 2 to 4 feet of mulch because of the trees and people didn't live here. And he said, you go through the mulch and go through the cap rock, and then you find fresh water. And so that's why the Navy came here, because they could exist here. And this, even today, people don't understand about solution holes, and they're even talking about it, and what happens over there at the new school is that when this layers were first in the ocean was higher and it was precipitated down, it was real soft limestone. And when it's soft limestone, but eventually the ocean went down, vegetation grew, and when vegetation grows and puts this mulch here, it creates acid when the rain goes to it. And remember, we got to remember, we get about 200,000 tons of iron dust and stuff from Africa every year, and so that gets mixed in. And when that did, it made that real soft rock much more dense. But you can, when you look at cap rock, you can actually see the layers of iron in there. So it's geology is really important, and that, and people don't realize. And the other thing in Key West, the reason we have a lot of trouble with streets, and they're having it, is when they built the streets or houses, they didn't pay attention to removing 2 or 3 or 4 feet of organic muck. They just put the road right on top of it, and of course, through the years, you just go sinking along.
Sinks.
and I think some of the other things that might be interesting.
Does anybody have any questions about anything?
Yes, go
ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was interested in hearing a little bit more about the slave ships and the research being done on those.
The 1860?
Yeah, the one up the Keys.
Oh, the one up the Keys, the Guerrero. Yeah, that was a project actually started by Dennis Trelawitz that Tom referred to earlier. He was working off the upper Keys looking for shipwrecks, and he and his guys were just swimming. They would just go and swim along the reefs of the Key Largo area and log things that they saw. Well, that's a wonderful way, and then lots of material that they found, but without the magnetometer, a lot of things get by. And so I get a lecture up in Key Largo on the Henrietta Marie, which was the slaver we've been working on. And afterwards, Dennis came up and said, "Hey, project we're trying to get off the ground, would you mind helping us and joining us?" And so, you know, we talked and saw the if it was feasible, and it was. And so we partnered with Dennis and the National Marine Sanctuary and the RPM Nautical Foundation and went and did magnetic surveys up off North Key Largo, Ocean Reef, which is where the historical documents said that the Guerrero was a slaver, wrecked in 1827. She was a pirate, too. And she's more of a pirate than you would say a slaver. Sailed out of Havana between 1825 and 1827. Would go from Havana to Africa, steal anything that they could along the way. We have letters written from some of her victims saying that they took everything but the clothes the crew was wearing. And then somehow they would get African people. And we don't know how, whether they traded the things they stole for them or whether they just stole the people somehow. We don't know. But anyway, in 1827, she had done one of these pirating voyages across the Atlantic and managed to get at least 561 African people on board, sailing back to Cuba to sell those people to the sugar plantations. And was spied by a British Navy vessel called the Nimble, a schooner, off just south of Bimini. Nimble was looking for slave ships. Slave trade was illegal, and Nimble was looking for slave ships to stop and arrest and liberate the people aboard. They tried to stop the Guerrero. Guerrero said, "No way," took off, headed towards Florida. They wound up getting in a gun battle. Night fell, and the Guerrero went and set at 10 knots, hit the reef, slammed into the reef off Key Largo. It says Carysport Reef, but that was all of Key Largo was called Carysport Reef at that time. It was a total loss. She tore her bottom out immediately, rolled over on her side, masts were sprung forward, 41 of the Africans drowned. And the Nimble saw, they were close enough that they could see that the Guerrero had wrecked. They tried to veer off, but they wound up hitting the reef as well. So they had two ships on the reef. Wreckers were stationed up at Caesar's Creek. So at dawn, they saw some ships on the horizon, skedaddled down, rescued the 90 pirates off of Guerrero, as well as the 521 Africans that survived. They also managed to tow Nimble off the reef. Dramatic story. The night that they had been rescued, the pirates being what they were, rose up against the wreckers, stole the wrecking vessels, and made it to Cuba. They got away with 400 of the Africans. The remaining pirates that were on the another wrecking vessel and on the Nimble, as well as 121 Africans, they were delivered down here to Key West. The Africans wound up being put to work clearing brush from the roads here in Key West for a number of months, and then eventually they were put to work on a plantation in North Florida, and after 3 years were finally taken to Liberia, where they lived out their lives, those who survived. It's a good book by Gail Swanson, if any of you know Gail. She wrote a wonderful history, follows the lives of these people and everything. It's called The Slave Ship Guerrero. You can get it on, probably a copy here in the library, but it's also, you can get it on Amazon. Anyway, so Dennis had been looking, and we joined forces with him, and we did those magnetic surveys back and forth and back and forth across the ocean, measuring the magnetism in the likely spots. And we wound up, we found three different shipwrecks, and we also found a spot that we know the Nimble threw over iron ballast and cannonballs to float itself off the reef. Well, we found a spot that was nothing but iron ballast and cannonballs. And so one of those wrecks looks like it is the Guerrero. Again, we don't have that little plaque that says "Welcome to the Guerrero." We have to find sort of a bunch of evidence that, you know, tips us over the edge. But so far, it's in the right spot. Everything that we know about Guerrero, she was sheathed in copper. She had 12-pound cannons. We find 12-pound cannonballs on this wreck. We find copper sheathing, musket balls. We know she had muskets. Some of the construction elements and the pottery and glass and things that we're finding all match the time frame perfectly. So we have been working with the Marine Sanctuary to document this site. We're going to go back up again this coming summer to do some more mapping up there. So it's a very much a work in progress, but it's a fascinating story, and I think once it's all said and done, we're going to have a really wonderful
resource. Who wrote the book?
Resource. I'm sorry?
Swanson.
Gail Swanson.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
I have a question for Ray. It's puzzled me for years. Why is West Summerlin Key to the east of Summerlin Key?
Because there were three keys. Again, Summerlin Key was Summerlin's possibly, yes. But then there were three. There was East Summerlin Key, West Summerlin Key, and East, Middle, and West. And when the railroad was built, these were very small keys, and it hooked them together. But where the Skull Camp is today, that was where some of the veterans came, and then there was a CCC camp there. And when they had that there, they had a post office, and the post office was West Summerlin. So it really was Summerlin's Key, and then there were three keys named after Summerlin. That's the reason for it.
There's one thing on naming keys, you got to understand how they name keys when they're doing a nautical chart. They send out a team from Washington, geodetic survey people, and they go around and they ask you what you call that key, and they ask you what you call it down the line, and they take a majority and they say, okay, that's Summerlin Key. So that's how a lot of them get their names, and names change. Woman's Key here takes switches with Man Key on a chart.
Typical key.
No reason, it just, you know, moved 3 miles.
There's a young fellow over there, once you pass.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of baloney about how Cudjoe Key got its
name. Cousin Joe's Key, excuse
me. No. Cudjoe is an African day name. And in 1849, when the Coast Survey was down here, they were told by, I think it was Sawyer, who was a pilot, that the name of that's Cudjoe's Key, apostrophe S. Right. And Cudjoe in West African lingo is the first day of the week, so it's really Monday Key.
I want to mention something about the cemetery, hurricanes, and the railroad. One of them is, in the 1846 hurricane, it blew down the lighthouse on the reef and the one Key West. There was no Kalki Channel before that. You could walk the Kalki and the Stock Island. And it blew that blue. And the only thing out of water was Solaris Hill, Elizabeth Street. There was about 500 houses here, and only 8 of them survived intact. Most of them were just blown over, sitting on the little blocks, and a lot of them were washed out. There were 1,500 people here, and I think there were 25 who died in the harbor and about 25 in the city. And with that little bit of water, fresh water they had, and a little bit of food they had, 1,500 people survived without any ice from FEMA. But the other thing that's interesting to show you that hurricanes can come again and could happen here is in about 1945, a hurricane came through Miami, just like Andrew. And it destroyed Homestead Air Force Base so bad that they didn't even try to rebuild it for 15 years. But a little farther over, where the zoo is today, that was Richmond Naval Air Station, 6 miles by 6 miles. Two of the largest buildings in the world. They were 1,000 feet long, 2.5 city blocks long, 270 feet high, 300 feet wide. And when this hurricane came through, they closed it up and they put in about 18 or 20 blimps. And then they put airplanes underneath them, about a couple hundred airplanes. Even private planes were allowed. Then they put vehicles. Well, these were built out of wood because it's wartime and there's a big structure there. And so the vibration of the building worked one of these big bolts loose and went through the wing of an aircraft that had a fuel cell, and that set it afire. And that is the greatest loss that the Navy had next to Pearl Harbor. Of all those blimps, and that's the reason you've got a Coast Guard station there. There's a secret Navy station that monitors everything. There's a housing antenna. There's a zoo. But the interesting thing is, one of the platforms of the blimp dirigible is still there, and that's a railroad museum. And you can see all the railroad cars there, and you just drive off and get in there. But to show you, Andrew happened in exactly the same track later on.
What did you say the name of the base was? The airfield?
Richmond.
Richmond.
And I think they have
it. They were called Richmond, too.
That's right. Richmond Heights. It's all the way up about 3 feet. The reason people don't realize why Flagler built the railroad down here, and he built it here. He didn't go to Miami because of some orange blossoms. He had his plans long before that, but he went there because they gave him a lot of land. The landowners did. Plus, he wanted to get that far anyway. But the reason he came here is because they were building the Panama Canal. And you couldn't get into Miami. It was only 8 feet. You couldn't get into Jacksonville. It's 8 feet. Savannah's 8 feet. The closest harbor was Charleston. If you were going to transship from Georgia or Florida, the closest port would be Key West. And this had a natural 24-foot harbor before they did any dredging. But when he did build this and it came down here, he had the Havana Specials would start in Pullman cars. It would start in Boston and go to Manhattan and come down here. It'd be a Pullman car moved all the time. So it would be down here a little over a day. And they got a room on a passenger ship. But he had the three largest ocean ferries in the world here. And the freight cars would go right on those, and a lot of them were yellow freight cars. And yellow freight cars is because they had ice, and instead of shipping live cattle, they shipped all kinds of meat from Florida. It went to Cuba. But what went the other way? The big thing was, when you see these huge storage tanks, they weren't full of oil, they were full of molasses. The whole ship would come full of molasses and pump it, and those tank cars on the railroad weren't oil. They were molasses that would go to Chicago and Boston. They made liquor out of it. They made all kinds of products out of molasses. A lot of sugar went, a lot of fresh vegetables. But the other thing that people don't realize, there's no such thing as Dade County pine. There's slash pine. And the slash pine that this place is built out of come from Mobile and Pensacola. And it's a hard pine because you can't tap it for the turpentine. And it's very dense. And that's why it's termite resistant. But by the time they got ready to build Miami, you got to remember, by 1890, this is still the largest city, and that's still a swamp up there. When they started building, they needed lumber. And the lumber came here from Oregon, Washington, and from Norway. And the lumber would come into Key West and go up on the railroad. It was a big product, was the wood here. And a lot of people don't realize it's halfway successful until the Depression comes. And then the Depression is interesting. Because a lot of people don't realize that was caused because the dollar was pegged to the pound. The pound was a big thing in the money world. And as the pound lost value, the dollar lost value. When the dollar lost value, these people buying property and stocks and bonds on 10%, the fine print always said you could have their cash on demand. And when people needed cash, all of a sudden, the banks, just like now, we've had a panic every 25 years because the banks gave money to people that weren't good, they didn't have the cash to cover when they needed it. And so that started, and that really affected Key West. Went down to 12,000 people. And then another thing about people don't realize, in World War II, it was started by President Roosevelt. Because President Roosevelt, in 1939, we were the biggest exporter of fuel oil, of aviation fuel and scrap iron to Japan. And when he told the Japanese, if they wouldn't get out of Japan, he was going to cut off that oil. And he knew that they couldn't run their navy and their industry without that oil. And how did that affect us here? Well, on the West Coast, the battleships went from the West Coast out to Pearl Harbor. And the reason they didn't get the two aircraft carriers, one was going to one island, one was going to the other, because they figured they'd hit farther up. Well, what they did at Key West here was put a neutrality patrol. You opened up the naval station. You put a seaplane squadron here. You put a marine squadron at Boca Chica. And he started building this place up in 1939, and they started the sonar school. We didn't have a sonar vessel in it. They got a Canadian vessel with some British equipment, and they started this sonar school, and that's how one of their submarines got sunk. They never did figure that out. It was in training. They used to use that as the target, and it got sunk here. But there's a lot of interesting history here, and it's all in books.
Thank you.